From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As Americans struggle with the coronavirus pandemic, the government appears to be ignoring the fate of a significant portion of the U.S. population, the incarcerated. Millions of people are held behind bars in local county jails and state and federal prisons. Considering the lack of an organized federal plan to tackle the spread of the virus overall, it's no surprise that prisons are being left to their own devices. And given the close quarters that prisoners are held in, COVID-19 has spread like wildfire inside facilities. Many states are only now scrambling to test inmates and finding serious waves of infection that could hurt prisoners, prison guards, and others. According to my guest, the Trump administration has failed to account for the uniquely American risk factor of our mass incarceration. The data is grim, and Alice Sperry, writing in The Intercept, shares that, quote, in the handful of facilities with higher test rates, most people were found to be positive. 8 of the 10 largest outbreaks in the country are in prisons and jails. Alice Sperry is a reporter for The Intercept, specializing in justice, immigration, and civil rights. She now joins me from Italy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you write how widespread these infections are in U.S. jails and prisons. Is it fair to assume that most prisons where there has been even one infection are likely a place where there are now majorities infected, and as we test, we find that out?
I think it's a fair assumption. We are testing far too few people everywhere, really, but particularly in prisons. And in the few facilities that have tested most people have also been found to be positive. I think one thing, you know, it's obvious there is no way to socially distance in prison. I mean, there are hundreds of people living together, sharing tables, sharing dorms. It is extremely difficult to maintain CDC guidelines in prison. There are also the question of protective equipment and protective gear. I mean, some prisons have started to give inmates access to masks or face coverings, but very late in the game. Some prisons are isolating the sick, but only those with symptoms. And we know that the virus spreads among asymptomatic people as well. So it's really just a terrible set of circumstances. And advocates, attorneys, anyone that's paying any attention to criminal justice issues in the country have been raising the alarm about this for weeks. So the deaths that we're now seeing in prisons that are really climbing by the day were absolutely predicted and predictable and avoidable, really.
Are they even counting infections and deaths in the national totals?
We have numbers. So first of all, one important point that my article makes is that there is no standardized data about this. There is no centralized repository of all this data, right? Because the criminal justice system by its nature is very fragmented. We have state prisons in 50 different states. We have a federal prison system that's run by the Bureau of Prisons. And then we have 3,000 jails that are run by local jurisdictions, right? So there is no one place where all of this data sits, and there is no standard in how prisons and jails are testing. And of course, on top of this, we have immigration detention facilities and facilities for youth as well. So we do have a few different projects, independent projects, that have been tracking infections and tracking deaths. And the most accurate and the most comprehensive, rather, I have come across is one that's run out of UCLA. And they have collected all of this data from all of these different jurisdictions and found that as of this week, more than 21,000 incarcerated people across the country were infected. However, the same project also found that 295 people had died after contracting the virus in prison and jails. And if you run the numbers, you realize that the number of infected that we know of is just not a realistic number. We know it's a massive undercount. And we know that there are many, many people who are not getting tested. I wrote a story just last week about the New Jersey prison system, where 34 people have died already, and only 185 had been tested at that point, which really gives you a sense of the disparity in access. Also, a lot of states are reporting staff infections as well, and we're seeing those numbers that are much higher, and it is not because corrections officers are getting infected more. It is just because they're getting tested more.
Staff as an STAFF as opposed to STAPH. So given that the federal government has essentially left all Americans to their own devices. The White House guidelines are vague. The CDC has guidelines, but they're being suppressed. Has anybody in the federal government, has the Bureau of Prisons, have any federal agencies actually laid out any sort of document, any guideline, any direction for how states should be handling their prison in populations, and even how the federal government itself should be handling the federal prison population?
Well, first of all, the way the federal government has handled the federal prison population is definitely no standard to go by. I mean, we've had a lot of infections, a lot of deaths in the federal prison system that were, again, totally avoidable. There have been a number of very vague guidelines. Attorney General Barr has put out a letter that's basically encouraging states to consider releasing some incarcerated people, and some states have done so. I mean, one point to make is that states have moved to release some people. The problem is that is hardly making a dent in the density of the population we have, and that is just because the U.S. incarcerates far too many people. I mean, we have 2.3 million people that are either in jail or prison or some other kind of detention right now, and you know, you have a few hundred people being released here and there, but that's not really making any significant impact on the problem. The other problem with the criminal justice system, and this is an issue always, and if anything, the pandemic is kind of highlighting this issue that's been a problem forever, is that it is such a decentralized system that there's no actual one place where, you know, responsibility and accountability and decision making happens. We have all of these power holders and all of these jurisdictions across the country that also make it very difficult for advocates and attorneys to target any one particular body for advocacy, right? Because you could be pushing your governor to do something, you could be pushing judges and district attorneys to you know, refuse to prosecute certain low-level crimes. There are a number of actors you could kind of lobby for action in this situation. And you know, attorneys and advocacy groups are doing that across the country, but it is a very painstaking. It's very difficult work when you have so many different centers of power in the system and so little data, which is, again, a point I come back to a lot.
So this underlying issue of the fact that we simply incarcerate too many people is one that activists and advocates have already been raising for many, many years. I'm sure there's been warnings of what could happen if there were a massive infection. And in fact, jails and prisons have been sites where infections of other diseases have spread. This is seemingly an issue that the U.S. ought not to be surprised is coming to haunt us now.
Absolutely. And, you know, the number of people we incarcerate is certainly part of the problem, but there's also the length of the sentences that people are given, right? There is an aging population in U.S. prisons. We have more than 200,000 people who are over the age of 55 who are incarcerated. That number has spiked by nearly 300% in the last two decades. We know that 40% of incarcerated people have at least one chronic condition, like asthma or diabetes, and we know that these are, you know, conditions that make someone particularly susceptible to COVID-19. So we have a number of health issues that prisons have been dealing with. And in a way, mass incarceration has been dealing with this kind of mass public health problem for, you know, for a long time. And COVID-19 has just kind of exacerbated all those problems. Another part of that story is the question of jails. So in prison, which is where people who have been convicted of crimes are sent, we tend to have an older population and a population with, you know, a lot of health problems. In jail, which is where people are held pre-trial or in some cases where people are held for misdemeanor convictions or lower level crime convictions, we see a younger population, but we also see a lot more people moving in and out, which, you know, makes them more susceptible to catching the virus and to spreading it into their communities. And particularly at this moment when we're seeing the virus starting to spread in rural America, there is a real question about jails that are in parts of the country that are already dealing with chronic lack of access to healthcare services. There was a recent report that showed that in Mississippi, Montana, North Dakota, West Virginia, more than one third of people who are in jail are in counties that don't have any ICU beds. So you can just get a sense of how disastrous this pandemic is going to be once it hits these rural jails as well.
And we know that the state of healthcare within the prison system is absolutely poor. You know, no surprise considering the state of healthcare outside prisons in the U.S. I want to ask you specifically about mental health. There are photos of inmate signs from Cook County Jail in Chicago that are absolutely heartbreaking. Inmates having, people who are jailed putting up signs in the windows begging for help. How serious is the fear, as far as you can tell, within jails and prisons of people who are basically trapped in a place where they are incredibly likely to catch the disease? They don't have the choice to be safer at home.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned Cook County Jail in Chicago, where six incarcerated people and two correctional officers have died already, and more than 900 people have tested positive. So you can imagine the fear of people that are in this jail that know that are seeing, you know, their friends and getting sick, and they know this virus is well into the facility and have very few ways to protect themselves. But also, I've been speaking with incarcerated people since this crisis started. And one important thing, as you mentioned, is the mental health aspect, right? Like, I mean, prison and jail are horrendous places at any time, but they're especially difficult right now. One of the first things that prisons did when the outbreak started, one of the first things they did in response to the outbreak was to shut down visitations, which, you know, makes sense. It was a measure that they took in an effort to reduce the spread of the virus, but it also completely isolated people who are already extremely isolated, right? So it meant that thousands and thousands of people are not seeing their families anymore. Many of them are not seeing their attorneys anymore. And so you can really imagine the stress that goes with that.
Also, are people being also denied parole or kept in isolation as a some sort of protection?
Yeah, and anyone who's shown symptoms has been isolated, isolation, if we talk about, you know, self-isolation in kind of like the general population outside prisons, once you're in prison, the way isolation works is you're sent to solitary confinement, which is, you know, we know has a devastating impact on people. That's something that we've kind of discussed at length before this pandemic. And yes, the only way you can be isolated in prison is really you're closed in a cell where you see nobody else and don't get out. And all of your meals are served to your cell, and you get maybe 1 hour of recreation a week. These are extremely harsh circumstances. But then another element I would bring up is the fact that a lot of people who are incarcerated tend to come from poorer communities, often communities of color, where the virus is where the virus is really having the largest impact. And so I've been speaking and corresponding with people who are incarcerated. They're scared for themselves, but they're also constantly hearing from people back home who are getting sick and kind of living with that double trauma of being inside while also hearing of loved ones that are becoming ill.
What's the sort of level of protest and activism around people who are trapped inside prisons and jails right now? It is a difficult time to be out there protesting because, of course, we're not supposed to be out unless we're getting groceries or going to the doctor. Social distancing rules, at least in, you know, many states, still require people to remain indoors. And yet often that sort of visible outdoor activism, can help to raise awareness of what's happening inside, right?
Yeah, there's definitely been some of that. I mean, obviously, yeah, as you said, socially distancing and protesting at the same time is challenging, but there have been protests, definitely in New York, which I'm most familiar with. There have been people going outside and protesting. One thing that tends to be the case often with criminal justice issues is that you have a lot of scrutiny in larger cities or on larger jails. For instance, Rikers Island in New York, there's a lot of attention paid to it. And the situation is terrible. On Rikers, we have hundreds of people infected, but there's also a lot of movement around it. One thing I'll say that's been really inspiring and quite incredible is since this crisis has started, there have been hundreds of motions filed with dozens of courts across the country. There have been lawyers and organizations and advocacy groups that have been filing for all kinds of releases, whether it's compassionate release or lower sentences or just like better conditions for the people who do remain inside. So there's really been a steady and massive effort to get people out, with some successes, hardly enough, but definitely some successes. But I think this really to go back to our original point, this kind of underlines the fact that there is no one centralized body. We have this massive sprawling prison system in the country. This, you know, the U.S. has been obsessed with mass incarceration for decades, and yet there is no one body in charge. And so there are all these disparate efforts across the country.
I understand that rather than the federal government, you have individual organizations and institutes that are trying to track, especially the spread of coronavirus in prisons and jails, the ACLU, the UCLA Prison Law and Policy Program, the Vera Institute, which all of which you cite in your article in The Intercept.
Yes, yes. There are a number of groups that have been really scrambling to get information. And these are groups that, you know, tend to be the ones that collect information on prisons and jails all the time. And that data is hard to come by at any time. And it is particularly difficult to come by right now. And one of the points they're making, and I think it's very important, is that, you know, a lot of states are now publishing death rates in their prisons because they're getting a lot of public pressure to do so. But what people I've been speaking with are saying is that it is very important to document that now, because once the crisis is over, it is very likely that states and corrections departments are going to rewrite the history of this pandemic and try to attribute deaths to other issues and kind of mask the massive impact this virus is having in prison. So I think it's a very important effort that we're seeing from various groups. There's also a database that I think I mentioned in my story that I think is very important that UCLA and the ACLU are running together. That's called Death by Incarceration, where they list the names of all the people they know of who have died in jail and prison across the country, as well as details about their case, their age, whether they'd filed for release ahead of or during the crisis. And then they leave a box in the spreadsheet for anyone that might have known the person. And this spreadsheet is public, although they haven't really advertised it widely. And I was speaking with someone from the ACLU who told me that someone actually just found a spreadsheet and left a tribute to a woman who died at a facility in Ohio. Wow. And which is important to remember when you see all of these numbers and all the spreadsheets of, you know, these are all people with stories, with, in this case, very tragic story. This is a woman who was abused by her husband for years and years, and was convicted of his murder, although she always maintained she was innocent, and spent 30 years in prison and died at the age of 74 of coronavirus.
You know, and we, of course, live in a country where our lawmakers have relied on such a dehumanization of the incarcerated, sort of, you know, resigning them to their fate. And you know, we're supposed to be thinking of them as criminals who deserve these punitive measures rather than human beings who are serving time for crimes they likely committed, and in some cases might not have committed, or just were victims of an unfair criminal justice system. Of course, there's a huge spectrum. There are violent criminals, and there are people who don't deserve to be there, but most of them are someone's son and daughter. Well, all of them are someone's son and daughter. Most of them are someone's husband or wife, brother or sister. They are real human beings. And I'm wondering if you can also give us a sense of the effectiveness at the state level, and which states have done better than other states, and, you know, humanizing their prisoners and actually doing something about it. We've heard a lot about New York City and the state of New York and Governor Andrew Cuomo's leadership in tackling the coronavirus crisis in his state, which is the hardest hit. Has that extended to the prison system in New York?
It has not at all. And New York is facing a real crisis in its prisons and jails right now. I mentioned Rikers earlier, where we've had several deaths, but also the state prisons are seeing a number of cases. And Governor Cuomo has really resisted a lot of calls for release and for kind of a lot of calls by advocates and groups from across the state asking for greater action in our prisons and jails. One thing that you mentioned, I think, is very important to bring up is the question of violent versus nonviolent crimes. And this is a dichotomy that's kind of been an issue in the criminal justice reform movement at large, if you can really talk of one movement, for a long time, because it's really stopped efforts at reform. And people have often said, you know, we should release everyone but violent offenders, which is, I think, is very problematic from a public health perspective. If we're just focusing on COVID, if we ignore the so-called violent population, we're not going to make a significant dent in the population. Like, we're not going to reduce the population enough. But also, I think it kind of undermines the whole question of you know, like humanizing people, I guess, like, you know, you can't humanize people except the violent ones, right? Like, it doesn't work that way.
There is no doubt
right.
about that.
And I think that's something that governors are absolutely doing. Cuomo multiple times has responded to requests to release people by, you know, talking about the violent ones. One thing that I'll note is that in the middle of this pandemic, Cuomo has moved to roll back bail reforms that had just been put in place in New York that helps drastically reduce the jail population by letting people wait for their trials at home. And we know that the rate of people that doesn't show up for court is minimal. It's just like very negligent. But there is such a political there's just like so much backlash around that, and a lot of politicians, Cuomo included, have kind of fallen for that. So you know, we saw in New York we have a 97% success rate in terms of people that are released on bail. That are released before their trials come up, show up for court, and it just the fact that, you know, someone, which is inevitable, goes out and commits another crime has been slowing down that whole effort. And
well, finally, Alice, what is the solution then? You know, there might be the one, you know, easy sounding solution on paper: release everybody. There might be let's improve access to healthcare, testing, personal protective equipment, find ways to socially distance within prisons, and then there's the do nothing, or, you know, let states just one by one figure things out on their own. And that seems to be the primary way. But what are activists, what are advocates, people who've really studied the prison system, who have long, you know, in a long-term manner talked about fixing this problem? What are they suggesting happen right now in the short term? Because yes, we can decarcerate in the long term, but to deal with COVID-19, what needs to happen in the short term?
I mean, I think there's a real need to decarcerate right now, and there are a number of people that could be let go right now. And I think that is really, if we're looking for health solutions to the crisis, that is the only way that is really going to make a difference.
But release everybody or just some? I mean, you were saying earlier that releasing some is not good enough.
Right. No, I think releasing as many as possible is the key. So I think, you know, releasing definitely anyone whose sentence is almost up, anyone who's at risk, anyone who's older, definitely anyone who's held pretrial, like either, or, you know, that could be eligible for bail and just doesn't have money to pay for it. So there are classes of people that should be released. And a lot of advocates that I mentioned earlier are focusing on specific groups of people so that they're, you know, making a claim for entire classes. Testing is definitely a huge problem. It has been a huge problem from the beginning of this pandemic in prisons, just as outside. In New Jersey, I mentioned a story I wrote about only, you know, less than 200 people being tested with more than 30 deaths. The state has moved to begin testing everyone in prisons, both incarcerated people and staff. So things like this, I mean, it's very late, but that definitely is important and is one step. And then I really think that what we're seeing now should just make us think about our mass incarceration system. I think this crisis should make us rethink a lot of things, really, in terms of the way our society runs. And mass incarceration is definitely one of them. One thing that I don't think I mentioned earlier is that this is a huge public health crisis inside jails and prisons, but it is also a massive public health crisis for everyone outside. Jails are becoming vectors for the disease. They're, you know, we have guards that work at jails and then go home and spread the virus in their own communities. We are seeing We're seeing jails and prisons become hotspots, but then really seeing the virus spilling out and infecting others. And one report I want to mention very briefly is the ACLU report that was released in April. Basically, the ACLU ran its own model and calculated that if one accounts for jails, just jails, not prisons and not immigration detention, the death toll is off. The death toll projections that the U.S. has been running with are off by at least 100,000 people.
Wow.
That means jails, the fact that we incarcerate as many people as we do in our jails will lead to 100,000 more deaths than we have been told. That just gives you a sense of how...
And that's not 100,000 incarcerated people. That's just 100,000 overall.
Exactly. Because that's the idea. These jails are becoming vectors. I've written other stories about this. In the last few weeks, you know, we're seeing a lot of cities kind of scale back on their policing of low-level crimes, but not all, definitely not New York City. And so every time someone is arrested in New York City for a broken windows, low-level kind of offense, the person who's being arrested is being exposed to the virus. All of the officers who arrest him are being, or her, are exposed to the virus. Anyone, you know, in the court system, so court staff, anyone in the jail, all of the other incarcerated people this person is held with, like every one person that moves through the justice system is exposed to the virus and exposes dozens of others to the virus. So you can see how that number grows then into 100,000 additional deaths.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Alice, for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article in The Intercept about this story. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Alice Sperry, reporter for The Intercept, specializing in justice, immigration, and civil rights. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.